From the Christian Classics Ethereal Library on the web at www.ccel.org. George Fox, an autobiography. Edited with an introduction and notes by Rufus M. Jones, M.A.L.I.T.T.D., Professor of Philosophy in Haverford College. Scanned and edited by Harry Plantinga. This text is in the public domain. Dedicated to the sweet and shining memory of the little lad whose beautiful life was a visible revelation to me of truth, which this autobiography teaches, that the divine and the human are not far sundered. It, George Fox's journal, is one of the most extraordinary and instructive narratives in the world, which no reader of competent judgment can peruse without revering the virtue of the writer, Sir James Mackintosh. The basis of his, George Fox's, teaching was the belief that each soul is in religious matters answerable not to his fellows but to God alone, without priestly mediation, because the Holy Spirit is immediately present in every soul and is thus a direct cause of illumination. From this central belief flow two important practical consequences, both essentially modern. One was complete toleration, the other was complete equality of human beings before the law. John Fiske. To sum up in fewest possible words the impression made by his, George Fox's, words and works upon one who studies them across the level of two centuries, he was a man of lion-like courage and adamantine strength of will, absolutely truthful, devoted to the fulfillment of what he believed to be his God-appointed mission, and without any of those sidelong looks at worldly promotion and aggrandizement which many sincere leaders of church parties have cast at intervals of their journey. Thomas Hodgkin. I have read through the ponderous folio of George Fox. Pray, how may I return it to Mr. School at Ipswich? I fear to send such a treasure by a stagecoach. Not that I am afraid of the coachman or the guard reading it, but it might be lost. Can you put me in a way of sending it safely? The kind-hearted owner trusted it to me for 6 months. I think I was about as many days in getting through it, and I do not think that I skipped a word of it. Charles Lamb to Bernard, Barton, Fed, 1823. Fox judged truly that the new Protestant scholasticism had not reached to the heart of things in any image of past experience, or in any printed book, however sacred. That academic learning was not in itself an adequate passport to the Christian ministry, that the words of God should not supersede the word of God. He realized, as few men have ever realized, that we are placed under the dispensation of the Spirit, that the power from on high with which the risen Christ promised to endue his people was no exceptional or transitory gift, but an eternal presence, an unfailing spring of energy, answering to new wants and new labors. He felt that the Spirit, which had guided the fathers, was waiting still to lead forward their children, that he who spoke through men of old was not withdrawn from the world like the gods of Epicurus, but ready in all ages to enter into holy souls and make them friends of God and prophets. Bishop Brooke Foss, Westcott. The next page is a map of the English counties and the principal towns visited by George Fox. Preface. The Journal of George Fox is one of the great religious autobiographies and has its place with the Confessions of St. Augustine, St. Teresa's Life, Bunyan's Grace Abounding to the Chief of Sinners, The Life of Madame Guyon, written by herself, in John Wesley's journal. The great interest which has developed in recent years in the psychology of religion and in the study of mysticism has most naturally given new interest and prominence to all autobiographical writings which lay bare the inward states and processes of the seeking or the triumphant soul. Professor William James has stated a well-known fact when he says that religion must be studied in those individuals in whom it is manifested to an extra-normal degree. In other words, we must go to those individuals who have a genius for religion, for whom religion has constituted well-nigh the whole of life. George Fox is eminently a character of this sort, as nearly every recent student of personal religion has recognized. Then again, his journal is one of the best sources in existence for the historical study of the inner life of the Commonwealth and Restoration periods. There were few hamlets so obscure, few villages so remote, that they did not have their streets traversed by this strange man in leather who always traveled with his eyes open. He knew all the sects and shades of religion which flourished in those prolific times. He never rides far without having some experience which shows the spirit and tendencies of the epoch. He never writes for effect, and he would have failed if he had tried. But he has, though utterly unconscious of it himself, filled his pages with the homely stuff out of which the common life of his England was made. The world events which moved rapidly across the stage during the crowded years of his activity receive but scant description from his pen. They are never told for themselves. They come in as byproducts of a narrative, whose main purpose is the story of personal inward experience. The camera is set for a definite object, but it catches the whole background with it. So here we have the picture of a sensitive soul bent singly and solely on following a divine voice. Yet its tasks are done not in a desert, but in the setting of great historic events. Here are the soldiers of Marston Moor and Dunbar, Cromwell and his household, Desborough and Monk, the quartering of regicides, and the new era under the second Charles. At every point we have vivid scenes in courts, in prisons, in churches, and in inns. People of all classes and sorts talk in their natural tongue in these pages. Fox has little dramatic power, but everything which furthers or hinders his earthly mission interests him and gets caught in his narrative. Pepys and Evelyn have readier pens, but Fox had many points of contact with the England of those days which they lacked. In its original unabridged form, the journal contains many epistles and long, arid passages which are somewhat forbidding, and it has always required a patient, faithful reader. It has, however, always had a circle of readers outside the religious body which was founded by George Fox. This circle has been composed of those who were somewhat kindred in spirit with him, and the circle has kept small, mainly owing to the inherent difficulties of the ponderous, unedited mass of material. Of the journal, in its complete form, there have nevertheless been 13 editions published, 9 in England and 4 in America. The present editor has undertaken the task of abridging and editing it in the belief that the time is ripe for such a work. The parts of the journal which have been omitted, and they are many, have gone because they possess no living present interest, or because they were repetitions of what is left. The story as it stands is continuous and in no way suffers by omissions. The writer of the journal lacked perspective. Everything that came was equally important, and his first editors in 1694 looked upon these writings as too precious and sacred to be tampered with or seriously condensed. The original manuscript, which has never been published, now in the possession of Charles James Spence of North Shields, England, shows us that the little group of early editors contented themselves with improving the diction, introducing some system into the spelling, and cutting out an occasional anecdote which they feared might startle the sober reader. The original manuscript is a little livelier, fresher, and more graphic than any published edition, though in the main we have in the editions a faithful reproduction of what Fox wrote. The notes which attend the text in this edition have seemed necessary for a clear understanding of the passages in which they refer. They have been made as brief and as few in number as the situation would warrant. The introduction is an attempt to put George Fox in his historical setting and to develop the central ideas which he expounded, though all points of detail are postponed to the notes. This estimate of his religious message is based on a study of the body of his writings, which are voluminous, and on the writings of his contemporaries and fellow laborers. It is a pleasure for the editor to acknowledge the valuable assistance which he has received from his friends, Norman Penny, John Wilhelm Rowntree, Joshua Rowntree, and Professor Alan C. Thomas. Among recent writers, the following have been appreciative students of George Fox: Thomas Hodgkin in his George Fox, Spurgeon in his George Fox, Bancroft in his History of America, Barclay in his Inner Life of the Religious Societies of the Commonwealth, Arthur Gordon's articles on George Fox in the Theological Review, and in the Dictionary of National Biography, Frank Granger in his The Soul of a Christian, Starbuck, author of Psychology of Religion, William James in Varieties of Religious Experience, Josiah Royce in The Mysticism of George Fox, Canon Curtis, Dissent and Its Relation to the English Church, see Chapter 5, The Quakers, Westcott's Social Christianity, see pages 119 to 133, The Quakers, and John Stevenson Rowntree, two lectures on George Fox. Introduction. There are mysterious moments in the early life of the individual which we call budding periods. They are incubation crises, when some new power or function is coming into being. The budding tendency to creep, to walk, to imitate, or to speak is an indication that the psychological moment has come for learning the special operation. There are two similar periods in the history of the race, mysterious times of gestation, when something new is coming to be, however dimly the age itself comprehends the significance of its travail. These racial budding periods, like those others, have organic connection with the past. They are life events which the previous history of humanity has made possible, and so they cannot be understood by themselves. The most notable characteristic of such times is the simultaneous outbreaking of new aspects of truth in sundered places and through diverse lives, as though the breath of a new Pentecost were abroad. This dawning time is generally followed by the appearance of some person who proves to be able to be the exponent of what others have dimly or subconsciously felt and yet could not explicitly set forth. Such a person becomes by a certain divine right the prophet of the period, because he knows how to interpret its ideas with such compelling force that he organizes men either for action or for perpetuating the truth. In the life history of the Anglo-Saxon people, few periods are more significant than that which is commonly called the Commonwealth period, though the term must be used loosely to cover the span from 1640 to 1660. It was in high degree one of these incubation epochs, when something new came to consciousness, and things equally new came to deed. This is not the place to describe the political struggles which finally produced tremendous constitutional changes, nor to tell how those who formed the pith and marrow of a nation rose against an antiquated conception of kingship and established principles of self-government. The civil and political commotion was the outcome of a still deeper commotion. For a century, the burning questions had been religious questions. The church of that time was the result of compromise. It had inherited a large stock of medieval thought and had absorbed a mass of medieval traditions. The men of moral and religious earnestness were bent on some measure of fresh reform. A spirit was abroad which could not be put down and which would not be quiet. The old idea of an authoritative church was outgrown, and yet no religious system had come in its place which provided for a free personal approach to God Himself. It has, in fact, always been a peculiarly difficult problem to discover some form of organization which will conserve the inherited truth and guarantee the stability of the whole, while at the same time it promotes personal freedom of the individual. The long struggle for religious reforms in England followed two lines of development. There was, on the one hand, a well-defined movement toward Presbyterianism, and on the other, a somewhat chaotic search for freer religious life, a movement toward independency. The rapid spread of Presbyterianism increased rather than diminished the general religious commotion. It soon became clear that this was another form of ecclesiastical authority, as inflexible as the old, and lacking the sacred sanction of custom. Then, too, the Calvinistic theology of the time did violence to human nature as a whole. Its linked logic might compel intellectual assent, but there is something in the man as real as his intellect, which is not satisfied with this clamping of eternal truth into inflexible propositions. Personal soul hunger and the necessity which many individuals feel for spiritual quest must always be reckoned with. It should not be forgotten that George Fox came to his spiritual crisis under this theology. Thus, while theology was stiffening into fixed form with one group, it was becoming ever more fluid among great masses of people throughout the nation. Religious authority ceased to count as it had in the past. Existing religious conditions were no longer accepted as final. There was a widespread restlessness which gradually produced a host of curious sects. Fox came directly in contact with at least four of the leading sectarian movements of the time, and there can be no question that they exerted an influence upon him both positively and negatively. The first sect in importance and the first to touch the life of George Fox was the Baptist, at that time often called Anabaptist. His uncle Pickering was a member of this sect, and though George seems to have been rather afraid of the Baptists, he must have learned something from them. They already had a long history reaching back on the continent to the time of Luther, and their entire career had been marked by persecution and suffering. They were independents, i.e., they believed that church and state should be separate, and that each local church should have its own independent life. They stoutly objected to infant baptism, maintaining that no act could have a religious value unless it were an act of will and of faith. Edwards, in his Gangrena, 1646, reports a doctrine then afloat to the intent that it is as lawful to baptize a cat or a dog or a chicken as to baptize an infant. Their views on ministry were novel and must surely have interested Fox. They encouraged a lay ministry, and they actually had cobblers, leather sellers, tailors, weavers, and at least one brewer preaching in their meetings. John Bunyan, who was of them, proved to general satisfaction that Oxford and Cambridge were not necessary to fit men to preach. Still stranger, they had what their enemies scornfully called she-preachers. Edwards has recorded this dreadful error in his list of